From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, this play that we've been talking about a survivor, an astonishing survival story from the Rwanda genocide. But we start with Marcus Bertone, Sacramento Bee columnist. He usually joins us the first Wednesday of the month. Not this week, though. He's joining us on Thursday. His columns usually appear in the paper's Our Region section. He's also a sports columnist occasionally at the Bee. Marcus Bertone, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you.
You know, it wasn't that long ago when most people either hadn't heard of the Twin River School Police Department or didn't think a whole lot about it, but they've been in the news an awful lot recently, and not for very good reasons.
Not for good reasons at all. On October 22nd, Twin Rivers police officer made a traffic stop somewhat near Grant High School in the Del Paso Heights area. The officer was shot 4 times, left for dead by the suspect. Sacramento police apprehended a suspect, and that suspect died in police custody. And so the issue became about that, but it also became about community feelings toward the Del Paso Heights School District and the police department. A lot of people don't know that some school districts have their own police forces, and the state education code allows for it and mandates that they have proper training. But the mandate there should be protecting students, faculty, and property. And the feeling in Del Paso Heights among particularly the African-American community is that this department oversteps its bounds too often. And a lot of people question why the stop was made that led to the shooting in the first place.
Are these quote-unquote real cops or the glorified security guards?
Well, it depends on who you ask. They would say that they're real cops. And they would say that they have the education code mandates that they have just as much training as Sacramento cops would. I would argue that, I wouldn't dispute that, but I would argue that they certainly have not acted like cops in the last couple of weeks since this incident flared. They have stonewalled in some respects. Only this week did they come out with a kind of interesting piece of information that the officer who was shot, the district maintains, was responding to a missing child report. Why don't you say that earlier? Why do you wait until there's this heated meeting to trot that piece of information out? They still haven't named the officer involved, which is peculiar. And the police chief involved has been invisible during big stretches of this. And so there's an issue of accountability. No one would ever suggest that it's right to ever fire on an officer, let alone try to kill an officer, which is what happened here. That's not the issue. That's not right, and that can never be tolerated. But if you're going to be a police force and you're going to say that you want to be a police force, then you have to be accountable like a police force, then there's to stand up before the public after an event like this, as opposed to circling the wagons, which, in my opinion, they've done.
And it seems like they respond to a lot of calls that are not on or even right next to school campuses. And as I understand, that sort of jurisdictional issue is a concern for the Sacramento Police Chief and the Sacramento County Sheriff.
It is a concern, and both the sheriff and the chief, they've been very careful, okay? And there is respect between departments, but it's not a stretch to say that both the sheriff of Sacramento County and the police chief have concerns, big concerns, sometimes this particular department responds to calls that should be going to the Sacramento Police Department. And you'll hear a lot of things anecdotally, and it's our charge at the Bee to try to lend weight to those and be specific. But there is a feeling among other law enforcement, not just related to this particular school police force, but to school police forces in general.
And as if all this weren't enough, there is a notorious T-shirt.
Yes. You raise them, we cage them, was a T-shirt that someone within Twin Rivers thought was funny, and apparently they sold, and it's a picture of a child behind bars, a child like out of Les Miserables or something, and with the little slogan, you cage them, or you raise them, we cage them. Okay, So let's, the psychology of that is this. You already have in the Del Paso Heights area an African-American community that feels that this department is targeting young African-Americans for arrest, incarceration, prosecution. So then all of a sudden this t-shirt comes out and it kind of proves people's points. It's disgusting. I mean, it's just there's no other way to put it. It's a disgusting example of just pure ignorance, and it's caused a lot of concern in the community. And you wonder why things like that happen.
Some people seem to think it was at least a mitigating factor that the child in the T-shirt appeared to be Caucasian.
Yes. As
I guess that's progress.
He appeared to be a Dickensian youth from, begging for porridge out of literature, but the message came through loud and clear just the same to some people.
My guest is Marcus Bertone, Sacramento Bee columnist. Another issue in the news recently was the revelation that the city council member had commissioned a poll to find out what the good people of Sacramento think about how an arena should be paid for.
Yes.
But you weren't buying it.
No. City Councilwoman Sandy Sheedy, who, by the way, represents Del Paso Heights. And before I move on to your question, Sandy Sheedy found the time to do this poll, this phony poll on the arena, but couldn't find the time to attend a community meeting related to the shooting, to personally attend a community meeting related to the shooting in Del Paso Heights. That being said, the poll purports to prove that there is widespread public support that the funding of the arena go to a public vote. And so when I saw the poll and I saw the questions that were very manipulative and didn't really do anything except try to manipulate people's opinions and emotions, the question that I had was, if you're going to send the arena to a public vote when you really don't have to, I mean, there's not going to be a general tax related to the arena that would require a public vote. If you're going to suggest that it should go to a public vote, then why are you a city council person in the first place? Then why even have a city council if issues related to land use and parking revenues and city policy are abdicated and you punt and send that to the public?
And generally speaking, if you ask the public, would you like to have a say on issue X, especially if it's controversial, who's going to say no?
Who's going to say no? And there isn't a funding mechanism or a plan set up yet. We do know that parking revenues for the city are going to be involved. Potentially, public lands owned by the city are going to be involved. And again, those are finance issues. Those are land use issues. That's why we elect these people, is to make those kinds of decisions. Show some leadership. Do your job. That being said, I personally don't believe that Councilwoman Sheedy has any lofty philosophical issues that are driving her. I just think she's trying to mess with the mayor.
My guest is Marcus Bertone, columnist at the Sacramento Bee. I know that you just can't wait for the day when you can take a high-speed train from Sacramento to L.A. so you can watch the Giants play the Dodgers.
Yes.
This week, the High-Speed Rail Authority released a revised, quote-unquote, business plan that said, actually, it's going to cost twice as much as we said it would just a few years ago to build the system. Are you reassured now?
Am I reassured now? I'm reassured that it's been... Well, I don't know if reassured is the right word. It reaffirmed for me how badly the public relations portion of the high-speed rail has been bungled. There's a group in town, the Sacramento Press Club, and they keep trying to have the high-speed rail folks make a presentation, and it keeps getting canceled at the last minute. Not the way to run a PR show, Jeffrey. So, and some of my colleagues have had a lot of fun writing about the choo-choo. I haven't really weighed in yet, but I do feel that we do need the high-speed rail. And I wish that there were a direct line to the Bay Area that would be fast and relatively inexpensive and reliable. I'm originally from San Jose, and when my father was alive, I often wanted to go visit him, and I tried taking the current Amtrak down there, and you're on the train forever. It's not reliable. On the way back, it took way too long, and it was not inexpensive. And when you consider that traffic is just getting worse in some of our urban areas, you know, we need the high-speed rail. So my hope is that they finally get a handle on the public relations aspect of it and calm some of the critics. You know, what my fear is, what's going to end up happening is that they're going to end up in the rush to appease people, they're going to scrap needed portions of this project. Being from San Jose as I am, the BART system in the Bay Area was never connected to San Jose because people in my region a long time ago were afraid of doing so because they thought that it was going to bring a lot of growth. Well, the growth happened anyway, and we never got the BART, and so all you got is gridlock from San Jose to the Bay Area. So
which
we
is,
need this.
Which is the biggest city in the Bay Area.
Yes.
Some people forget that.
Yeah, some people forget that. And so we need this, and if you travel the corridor now, try going from Sacramento to San Francisco on any day of the week at this point, and you're sitting in traffic going, why am I clogged up in Fairfield? Why is it clogged up in Davis? So we need this, and my fear is that it's just getting caught up in kind of the mosh pit of California politics.
Finally, Marcus, if it weren't for billionaires squabbling with millionaires, this morning we'd be talking about how the Kings did last night
yes.
in their regular season home opener. That didn't happen because of the NBA lockout. We keep getting tantalized about imminent breakthroughs,
yep.
and then the breakthroughs fall apart and no one talks to each other. What do you think is going to happen?
I think the owners are going to prevail over the players.
Because they hold the cards.
Because they hold the cards. The players had a good deal and they passed it up out of spite, out of hubris, out of arrogance. And the deal that they're going to get after the first of the year is going to be worse than the deal that they would have gotten a few weeks ago. They're going to cost themselves a lot of money just to prove a point. And the point is that they wanted to, it was just a manhood thing for them. So I suspect that there will be NBA basketball sometime in January and February, and that the players in the long run will have wished that they made a deal to preserve an entire season.
And not incidentally, it'll be a shorter season where every game will matter more.
Every game will matter more, and you can argue that this season lasts too long as it is. So you, as a Kings season ticket holder, I look forward to there being games someday.
Marcus Bertone of the Sacramento Bee, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, the inspirational story of how one woman survived the Rwanda genocide. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Joining us this morning with Insight Online is Associate Producer Lynn Weaver. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, Jeffrey. You've just heard Sacramento Bee columnist Marcus Bertone. What do you think about the Twin Rivers controversy surrounding the police department? Do you think the T-shirts have an influence on how the police union is seen in the community? Send us an email to insight@capradio.org or write us a comment on our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio. And don't forget, we tape all our shows. Go to capradio.org/insight and look for today's podcast.
Well, I will. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
For all the horror of the Rwanda genocide, over 500,000 people killed in a few months, inspiring things happened too. Like the astonishing story of a woman who survived hiding for months in a bathroom. It's told in a powerful one-woman stage show that's traveled the world. Actress Leslie Lewis Sword created Miracle in Rwanda in 2007. She's at the Mandavi Center this week. Leslie came by our studio, along with a UC Davis student who is himself a Rwanda genocide survivor. I asked Leslie Lewis Sword to tell us about the woman at the heart of her play.
Immaculée Ilibagiza is a woman who was 24 when the genocide started. And she survived by hiding in a 3-foot by 4-foot bathroom for 91 days with up to 7 other women and children, so 8 of them in there by the end.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And while she was in there, killers would search the house. This was the house of a Hutu pastor who was sympathetic towards her and the other women. But the killers would come to the house and search for them every other day. And they were in an undiscovered second bathroom that was hidden by a wardrobe put in front of the door. And the killers never found them, blessedly. It's actually more miraculous. I've actually been to that house. I went to Rwanda to see it. And if they had ever come through the back door, they would have easily have seen the room. But because of their pride, I think, they never did.
And why did these people want to kill Immaculée and the others hiding with her?
Because they were Tutsi. And there was longstanding tensions between the Tutsi and the Hutu tribes, although they were less like tribes and more like political parties at that point because of so much intermarriage. But there was a longstanding division because the Tutsis had been the ruling class in Rwanda and then were made into an overlord class by the Germans, then the Belgians during
colonial period.
And then once colonial period ended, there was a series of backlash against from Hutu majority against the Tutsi minority.
And how did you learn about Immaculée's story?
I heard her speak with Dr. Wayne Dyer. She met him soon after writing about her experience. And as soon as he heard a little bit of her story, he said, I'm going to help you publish that. And he brought her around with him while they were working on the book for a year in speaking engagements. And so I heard her speak. And 2 weeks later, I met her at a conference. And 2 weeks after that, I just got on a plane to Rwanda to meet her there with a documentary crew that was doing the story of her life. And so that's how I met the pastor and saw the bathroom where she was hidden. It was tiny. It's 3 feet by 4 feet. That's so small.
Well, it's one thing to hear an inspiring story and to meet this amazing person, but it's another thing to make a play out of it. How did that happen?
Well, I'm an actress, and I'd gone to UCLA to learn my craft, and our final project was making a one-person show. And so as soon as I heard her say, and here's why I'm telling her story, because it's not just amazing that she survived. What's amazing is that she is a happy person today, and she found the divinity, the goodness that's at the core of every human being while she was in that bathroom, while they were searching for her. She found a place of peace within her, even though there was chaos on the outside. And that's a message I think anyone can understand, that no matter what is going on, whatever chaos is happening on the outside, there's a place of stillness within that we can find. And that's when I knew. She said she realized the first time that the killers came to the house, and I'm going to speak using her voice, what she would say. She said, I felt so afraid. It was as if their knives were already cutting into my body. And I realized my thoughts would kill me before the killers ever did. Her pain at being searched for was so intense, but she was safe. She was in the bathroom. Nothing had happened. She realized that she had to refocus her mind onto something that felt good in order to survive that experience. And she did. What she did was she prayed the rosary. She was a very devout Catholic. Her father had given her a rosary before she saw him for the last time, and she decided to pray the rosary every moment of the day from 6 in the morning till 11 o'clock at night. And it transformed her. It became mantra meditation. And so she came out of that bathroom a changed person to the point where she could forgive the man who had killed her mother.
My guest is actress Leslie Lewis-Sword, and she is the star of a one-woman show based on the story of a Rwandan genocide survivor. And the show is called Miracle in Rwanda, and it's at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis on November 3rd and 4th. How do you tell such a big story that part of it is in a very enclosed space with a lot of people in a relatively small space, but then bursts out of there and is in the context of a genocide happening in a whole country? How can you tell that story as one woman on a stage?
Well, that's why people should come see the show tonight.
Very good.
And find out. The bathroom is delineated by just 3-foot by 4-foot square of tape. And that's my job as an actor. I play every character in the story. So I play a Hutu killer who searches for her. I play the pastor. I even play visions of Jesus and Mary, because that's what happened to her while she was in the bathroom. It was like she was on a vision quest while she was in there. Under extreme physical duress, she lost 40 pounds while she was in there. She had these visions that showed her of the higher realm that's possible to experience.
Also with us in our studio, Ephrem Rukundo, a UC Davis student. He's from Rwanda. Ephrem, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
How old were you when the genocide happened?
I was about nine.
Yeah. And you managed to escape.
Well, I managed to survive. I didn't really, it was like, keep hiding places to places until finally finished.
Yes. You lost people in the genocide, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And I understand that this is very painful for you and you prefer not to talk about it, but, you know, it's inevitably part of the discussion when we do this. When did you leave Rwanda?
To come here to school, I started school here in last year in the fall.
I see. So you still live in Rwanda. Do you intend to go back?
Yeah, eventually I will go back at some point. If I don't know, after I finish my school and other experience I need from this country.
Yes. Leslie, tell us how you and Ephraim met, because Ephraim says he first saw the play in Rwanda.
Yes. I was invited to do a festival in Rwanda, and so I had the blessing of doing it at the university at Butare, or Huye, it's called now. And I was upstairs in the lodgings that they had for me, and I look over and I see this young this businessman looking guy. He had an iPhone and a laptop, and I was so impressed with him. I mean, it was just clear that he was someone going places. And I invited him to the show that night, and the next day I saw him there again, and he said, "I saw your show, but I couldn't stay." And my heart went out, and he told me why he couldn't stay, that it just reminded him, as he just said. And my heart just went out to him, and I'm so amazed. He thought he would never see me again. A year later, I was doing the show in Vancouver, and there he was in the audience. He's just an amazing person. And I just asked him while we were outside, how did you get from being, because he told me that his family was farmers, you know, they'd lived off the land. No one had had more than, you know, an elementary school education. Now here he is getting his master's at UC Davis. And so I asked him, and he spoke English so well. And how did you learn English?
I tried most of the time to read New York Times, listen to some BBC News, and like tried to keep up because I needed English to go further in my education.
And what are you studying at UC Davis?
I'm studying international agricultural development.
Yes. Is it a coincidence, Ephraim, that you're here studying at UC Davis and Leslie, you're doing your show on the UC Davis campus?
No. So that's exactly it. When I saw him in Vancouver, we started to talk, and his sponsor
My host family.
His host family, Craig, decided to bring the show to UC Davis as a fundraiser for an organization.
Rwanda Rising?
Yes.
Yes. Ephraim, you said that the first time you saw the show Miracle in Rwanda, you couldn't watch the end of it. It was a bit too painful at that time. When you watch it now, what's it like?
When I watch it now, I realize that I can, you know, handle it. And in any way, it's like the story that has to be with me all the time. And the best way is to just like try to see it as the history. It happened, so I have to keep forward, keep living in the future, and not getting trapped back in the past.
Well, it seems like you're doing well for yourself, and it sounds like Immaculée Ilibagiza, who's the woman at the center of the story in the play Miracle in Rwanda, is doing well. But generally speaking, Ephraim, how are the people of Rwanda doing today?
I think they are doing very well than many people probably here think it is. It has been a while until the, you know,
17 years.
Yeah, from say 17 years, and there has been a lot of going on, like building the country, trying to just push forward the development and everything, and try to get the new generation like to overcome that division and everything, so that they can together like try to build up the country.
And that division between the Hutu and the Tutsi that was at the heart, that was underlying the genocide, how is that today? Do people still feel that division?
It's a little it's not a simple question to answer, but it's not written in ID as it used to be.
You don't have to carry ID cards around.
You don't have to carry your ID around with the, you know, Hutu or Tutsi written in it as it used to be back in then. So it's, but obviously, you know, your neighbors, people are neighbors, they know who is who. And it's not that you can be walking on the street and say, oh, this man is Hutu, this man is Tutsi. No, you can't say that.
You
cannot tell. It's not that people live in one side of the country and other people live in one side. No, everybody lives, it's in the mix. They go to the same church, they go to the same school, they speak the same language, they look alike.
It's so, like Republicans and Democrats.
It makes it all the harder to understand the animosity behind the genocide then.
Or not.
Well. Yeah.
And Leslie, when you talk about Immaculée, you adopt her voice. Mm-hmm. What's it like being this person, at least in part of your life, for years now?
It is the biggest honor of my life. Well, one of. Getting to play her is such a gift because who she is as a human being is amazing. Someone to live through, well, but similar to you, Ephraim, mm-hmm. to live through what you both lived through and yet be happy people who are doing wonderful things with their lives, that is an incredible gift for me. And it's a special gift because the last day that I was there in Rwanda with her, she brought me to an orphanage. And my husband and I had already decided that we were ready to start our family. And we were going to do it domestically. But then I went to this orphanage and I saw this room full of babies. And when I came home and showed my husband the pictures, we decided, okay, let's do this. And so 7 months later, we went back and picked up our children.
Oh, my goodness.
Our two kids, Christian Roy Vincent Hamadoun Harilimana Lewis Sword, and Sevilla Joy Innocent Nyankuru Lewis Sword. And so now she's like the godmother to my kids.
And what does Immaculée say when she hears you adopting her voice when you talk about her?
I was saying this in the car, that most people are like, oh, wow, you're so good at the accent. She's like, that's not me.
That's great.
What's wonderful about her is that she has a great sense of humor. Mm-hmm. You know, just like you, Ephraim, she really would prefer not to talk about it that much because it's in the past and it was very painful, but there's so many wonderful things now in the future. And she said once, you know, I wish I could just talk about shoes.
Miracle in Rwanda. It's at the Mandavi Center at UC Davis tonight and tomorrow, November 4th at 7 p.m. It stars Leslie Lewis Sword, who joined us today. Also joining us today, Ephraim Rukundo, who's a student at UC Davis, a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. And he's seen the play many times. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, veteran jazz drummer Jimmy Robinson. Over the years, he's played with many big names in jazz, and he plays Auburn this weekend. It's Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? Joining us with the answer to that question is Alan Ray, Capital Public Radio senior editor in our newsroom. Alan, what's in the news?
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. Think Big Sacramento, the major group behind the push for a new arena for the Kings, is holding a public meeting today to talk about what's called a parking public-private partnership. Think parking meter as investment tool, revenue source. The concept, in the words of the news release, is to leverage the city's parking assets to attract new private sector investment and create jobs. All that from the lowly parking meter, Jeffrey. Now, with the Greek government on the edge of collapse, the prime minister there has backed down from his plan to hold a national referendum on that Eurozone bailout plan. That news seems to have relieved investment markets. Wall Street is sharply higher. And now we have 40 House Republicans, a number of whom signed Grover Norquist's No New Taxes pledge, now saying the super committee trying to deal with the nation's huge debt should be looking at new revenue sources. Could that mean taxes? Or maybe the super committee should be considering a public-private partnership to leverage the nation's parking assets. Those stories on All Things Considered beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on Capital Public Radio.
Thank you, Alan.
My pleasure.
Over the years, we'll make that decades, drummer Jimmy Robinson has played with many top names in jazz, including Chet Baker, Bobby Hutcherson, Milt Jackson, Woody Shaw. He's also a band leader with a CD called In Your Own Sweet Way and a concert this Saturday in Auburn. He's in our studio. We'll speak with Jimmy Robinson in a minute. But first, from In Your Own Sweet Way, here's Jitterbug Waltz. Jimmy Robinson, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, that was you playing the drums there, of course, and the pianist, Joe Gilman, who's with you on Saturday night.
Correct. One of my favorite pianists.
Yeah. How long do you go back with Joe Gilman?
Oh, maybe 25 years.
Really?
Yeah. Could be longer, a couple of years shorter, but a long time I've known Joe.
Yeah. Now, you go back even before those 25 years in your career in jazz, and in the 50s, you spent a lot of time in England. Why was that?
Well, I was blessed to get to England. I'll start off by saying it that way. I was 19 years old when I got to England, stationed at a base called Burton Wood, which was in between Liverpool and Manchester.
So you were military then?
Yes, in the Air Force. And so I went downtown to find a place to play, and I found this place called the Club 43. So I went in there to play. And as they tell me in England when I talk to them, and the rest is history. I made history in a book that just come out, A Keeper of the Flame, which is really high honor for me. It's been about 6 months since I've had the book, and I'm still on cloud 99, really. It's a wonderful experience. So England taught me a lot. I got to play with the very best of players during that period of time at 19 years of age.
Was there much jazz in Northern England in the early 50s?
Oh, yeah. I was shocked. What I discovered when I landed there is how far they were into jazz. Just a lot further than any place I had been in America up to that point. They knew the people who started jazz. They knew instrumentalists. They knew the stylists. They knew the singers. They knew the periods of time. And they knew the distinction between the eras of jazz from one generation to the other. Actually, being 19, I discovered that I had to do some studying, is what I found out when I when I got to England.
My guest is Jimmy Robinson, jazz drummer. He's in concert at the State Theater in Auburn on Saturday night with some of his musical friends, including the pianist Joe Gilman. Let's listen to another track from your album, In Your Own Sweet Way. This is an arrangement of the very famous song, Three Blind Mice. Jimmy, the drummer in pretty much any kind of band often plays towards the back of the stage, although usually in the center. What's it like when, like in this record here, where you're the leader of the band?
I don't go in the back when I'm the leader. It's basically just that simple. And the reason that I don't is because if it's my job, it's my job. And I've been told by people, especially at the Arts Council, they really don't like anyone standing in front of me. And since they pay the money, I try my best to accommodate them. And the other thing is I've earned the time and the place to play and do what I want to do up there. That's basically how I feel. And I have problems with musicians, too, who think that they should stand in front of me.
Oh, yeah?
I usually fire them when they feel like that. I don't have any need to keep someone around like that. You have to distinguish between what's yours and what's mine. It's just basically that simple.
Obviously, you haven't had that problem with Joe Gilman.
Oh, no. No, you don't have problems with A and B players.
But having
Joe
said
is an A player, you don't have problems with those guys. They know what to do. You don't have to talk much. You don't have to say much to them. It's the other guys that you have problems with.
Having said that, you have played over the years with many well-known names in jazz, very well-known names. Who's your favorite memory from all those people over the years?
Well,
tough one.
I got several, but the one that I would pick would be with Eric Dolphy in Paris. in 1964. This was 2 weeks before Eric died. I was playing at a club called Shakupesh with Donald Byrd's quartet. Eric came over with Charlie Mingus' band and decided to stay in Europe because he was struggling in America. They didn't understand his music. They didn't like his music too much. And but when he came to Europe, he found pretty much what I found, that the European people really loved his playing. And so Eric was on his way to become a gigantic star when he passed, man. But the 2 weeks that I played with him, because he just showed up, he was one of these musicians. He just showed up with his horns. Whoever in town that he knew guys could play, that's where Eric would be.
Jimmy Robinson, jazz drummer, he's in concert in Auburn this Saturday night. We've got time for one more track from your album, In Your Own Sweet Way. And this is a drum solo written by you and played by you. It's called Katrina the Hurricane. Of course, this is more than a solo. This is a song, I guess you could say, but with one instrument, and it's about something. How did you create it?
Difficult. But as an artist, I wanted to express something about Katrina, so the best way that I can do that is through my drum set. So what I try and do there is to have visual images of what I saw on television during the period of time that was taking place down there. And so I try and think about wind, upsurges of rain, even alligators that I saw swimming, people asking for help, whatever images I can come up with, someone seeing their life destroyed right in front of them. So I try and create what I can from those verbal images. And since I played that solo, I think I've gotten better at doing it. I'm still working on it because it's something. It's a heavy thing to do, and a little bit audacious to try and do, but I like trying to do something that's not like everything else. So,
Jimmy Robinson and friends are at the State Theater in Auburn on Saturday night at 7:30. It's the first in a series of music shows to be presented there, where supporters are raising money to restore the State Theater to its 1937 Art Deco grandeur. Jimmy Robinson, thank you so much for joining us today on Insight.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, Russian orchestral music, a famous piano piece arranged for brass, and more on this week's Classical Sound Advice. It's Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Here's your weather. Cold and windy today in the mountains with a chance of snow showers. Today's high in Tahoe City, 48. Also there, it's opening day for 36 views of Lake Tahoe from 36 mountain peaks, an exhibit of watercolors by painter and hiker Norma Carter. The show at North Tahoe Arts opens this morning at 11. Otherwise, in weather, 64 today in Sacramento, 61 in Marysville, 70 in Modesto, 51 in Grass Valley, and 60 in Carson City. Chance of showers tomorrow morning, then gradual clearing. It's time now for our regular music feature, Sound Advice. Each Thursday, we bring you new releases. This Thursday, the first Thursday, it's classical music, and the man with the CDs is Capital Public Radio's classical morning host, Kent Teeters.
Lots of great music, some Russian music, music for harp, and also some rather unusual brass arrangements. And to start off with, this, I think, is just absolutely a perfect example of how to create sonic color with an orchestra. Thank you.
lively start to Sound Advice, and that was?
This was Capriccio Espanol by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov. Rimsky-Korsakov sat down with a book of Spanish songs and decided they would be perfect material for a showpiece for orchestra. When the piece was premiered in 1887, it was an instant hit, and it quickly became part of the standard repertoire for orchestras. It continues to be a favorite today. This is a brand new recording, 2011 recording from Seattle Symphony with conductor Gerard Schwartz on the Naxos record label. It's all music by Rimsky-Korsakov. It begins with Capriccio Espanol. It includes several fine overtures, and then the bookend of the CD is a Rimsky-Korsakov work that is just as famous as Capriccio Espanol, the Russian Easter Overture.
Very nice, and it has kind of a Russian feel to it.
Well, of course. The Russian Easter Overture interpolates some church tunes from the Orthodox tradition. And I have another recording, also from Gerard Schwartz and Seattle Symphony on Naxos Records. Again, another 2011 release, Russian music again. This time it's the symphonies of Alexander Borodin. Two complete symphonies and a third symphony that he left unfinished. Borodin was not prolific. He was a chemistry teacher and a research scientist by day and a composer by night. So he didn't write a lot of music, but what he did write is considered to be some of the best music to come from the Russian Romantics. In fact, he was one of a well-known group of Russian composers known as the Five, sometimes called the Mighty Five or the Mighty Handful. there's five fingers, so
makes sense.
Rimsky-Korsakov was part of that circle of composers. The Second Symphony by Alexander Borodin seems to be the one most enjoyed by audiences. I love it. This is the final movement from Alexander Borodin's Second Symphony.
You're listening to Sound Advice on Insight. My guest is Capital Public Radio's classical morning host, Kent Teeters. And Kent, we've had a good helping of Russian music, but we're going to go north of the border next, I think.
Yes, a change of pace, change of texture, change of nationality. I'm not aware of much, if any, music that Johannes Brahms composed specifically for brass instruments. Brahms was, a pianist. He composed great piano music. Four famous symphonies, several concertos, and other works. So creative bunch of musicians that they are, the members of Canadian Brass came up with some delightful brass quintet arrangements of the keyboard music of Brahms. Brahms on Brass is the name of the CD from Opening Day Records. The 16 waltzes for piano by Brahms work quite well on brass instruments. And this is the Waltz No. 15 by Brahms, arranged and played by Canadian Brass.
Well, like many people, I'm familiar with that on piano, but it sounds like it could have been written for brass.
Doesn't it, though? And it's just so warm and comforting.
Yes.
And, I think Brahms would have loved it himself.
Yes.
Well, let's go back a few years, so to speak. What they can do with recording technology is just really astounding. This is a recording made almost 40 years ago, 1973. Reissued this year by Pentatone Classics, and it sounds as bright and clear as if it were done yesterday. Three concertos for harp and orchestra, one from a fellow they sometimes call the French Mozart, François Boieldieu, another from 20th century Brazilian composer Heitor Villa-Lobos, and this from a man best known for his works for guitar and orchestra, the Spaniard who composed the famous Aranjuez guitar concerto, Joaquin Rodrigo. Catherine Mitchell plays the harp. This is the Concerto Serenade by Rodrigo.
That was really beautiful. I really enjoyed listening to that. I wasn't familiar with it.
Charming music, and you can, of course, hear the Spanish influence, and obviously, with Rodrigo himself being a guitarist, it was an easy thing for him to come up with a harp concerto.
And as you said, this was originally a 1973 recording before they were using any of the modern digital recording technologies, but it had the sparkling sound to it.
It's just a great CD from Pentatone Classics.
Ken Teeters, Capital Public Radio's classical morning host, with us today for sound advice. Ken, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and today's associate producer is Lynn Weaver and Liz Cazares. The assistant producer of Insight is James Morrison. The technical director, Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll be back tomorrow. It was 15 years ago this month when California voters approved medical marijuana. On the next Insight, we'll talk with a man who's been fighting to legitimize the medical cannabis industry that whole time. Also, two artists have just turned a water tower in Davis into a work of art. Plus, Capitol Stage debuts its new theater with Superior Donuts, a comedy about a former 60s radical, and our weekly Capitol chant. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock on Capitol Public Radio.